You're listening to WOMM LP, the Radiator 105.9 FM in Burlington, Vermont.
Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Sharon Matola, founder and director of the Belize Zoo, in the second of a two-part interview. Last week, in part one, we talked about the Belize Zoo and her work with jaguar rehabilitation. Today, we'll talk about her fight against the Cholula Hydroelectric Dam in Belize that threatened a number of rare species, including the country's last scarlet macaws. We'll also talk about her work with tapirs. Sharon Matola defies definition. She's an American-born, motorcycle-riding, lion-taming, monkey-smuggling Air Force veteran who's fluent in Russian, as well as an expert in jungle survival, mushrooms, and tapir biology. In 1983, she started the Belize Zoo as a home for a collection of 20 wild animals used in a documentary film she'd worked on about tropical forests. Today, the Belize Zoo and Tropical Education Center has grown to about 170 animals, including jaguars, tapirs, harpy eagles, and macaws. The main purpose of the zoo is to educate Belizeans about their natural resources. Not only does the zoo contain only Belizean animals, but it also has many educational programs for adults and school children alike. Fodor's Travel has praised it as being one of the smallest, but arguably one of the best zoos in the world. However, it was hard hit by Hurricane Richard in late October 2010. While none of the animals were injured or escaped, it needs help rebuilding. For more information, visit belizezoo.org. Sharon Matola is outspoken in her passion to protect the forest ecosystem that is the home to the animals she views as Belize's natural treasures. Her most famous effort, which was documented in the book The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird by Bruce Barcott, began in 1999 when she learned that the Belizean government, together with a Canadian power company, planned to build the Cholula Dam. This was a $44 million, 8-megawatt hydroelectric dam on the Macaw River that would flood an undeveloped area of moist forest in central Belize and destroy the habitat of the 200 scarlet macaws remaining in the country. Government officials denied the potential impacts on these birds, saying that they're birds, they'll fly to other trees. The problem is that scarlet macaws need specific types of trees. The trees must be able to support a nest, provide a 360-degree view to watch for predators, and provide a variety of food to eat. Sharon spurred other native Belizeans and international organizations like the Natural Resources Defense Council into action, and, with their help, undertook a 6-year campaign against the Cholula Dam. But there was great personal cost. Government officials branded her an enemy of the state and threatened to locate a new national garbage dump next to her zoo, which would have destroyed it. In the end, Matola and her colleagues lost. The dam went online in 2006, and since then, habitat has been destroyed, electricity prices have risen, and water quality in the river has deteriorated. In addition, the two principal Belize government leaders pushing the dam, the then Prime Minister and the former National Security and Housing Minister, were charged in December 2008 with stealing $10 million from the people of Belize. As you listen to the following interview, you'll hear more about this battle and what spurred Sharon to take action. You'll also hear about some of her recent projects, especially her work with tapirs, an important endangered species. Tapirs are the national animal of Belize. They've been around for millions of years and are related to the rhinoceros. They're important seed dispersers in the forest ecosystem, and Sharon has recently written a book about one who came into her care after he lost his mother, called Tombo the Tapir. When he was less than 2 months old, Tombo's mother was shot and he was taken to be sold as a pet. While both activities are illegal, unfortunately, Tombo's story is not unique. Tombo was rescued and brought to the Belize Zoo, where he's since enjoyed a life filled with love and attention. Yet his story doesn't end there. He'll soon move to the Chetumal Zoo in Mexico, where he'll not only serve as a tapir ambassador, but a political one as well, as he represents the need for connectedness of the forest resources of Mexico, Belize, and Guatemala. When we spoke recently, I asked Sharon about her work to maintain forest connectivity and how that fit in her fight against the Chililo Dam.
You were talking a lot about the connectivity issue, and I know you've worked on that in other venues as well. In particular, I wanted to talk with you about your fight with the Chililo Dam and the Scarlet Macaws. And in fact, I know you were named an enemy of the state in fighting that dam. So I was wondering if you could describe what happened, you know, where it is and what it used to be like, because the dam has since been built.
Three dams.
And they're...
But Chililo was the big one that flooded that area and where I used to study the macaws. And it was 5 years of my life living out there where, you know, I mean, just never saw another human. It took a long time to even get to the place where you put the kayak in and then off you went. It was just an arduous field study situation. But the data that
And you were studying
acquired,
scarlet macaws there or
a number
of different animals?
Well, I a long time ago, I went out there and took some notes on the tapir situation there. It was really, really a very vibrant area for tapirs. So I did a small study on the seed dispersals of these guys. I would collect tapir dung, which was really easy to find, and then take it back and dry it and see what grew out of it. And some of it did produce some vegetation, which was interesting. But I would just make that information available to the tapir specialist group network. None of it got formally published. But that's what started when I was doing that, and funded by an organization called Wildlife Preservation Trust International. Subsequently, they changed their name to Wildlife Trust, but I noticed some macaws out there. Every day, scarlet macaws, and I know that they're really rare birds. So the study evolved into a formal study on the ecology of these birds because nobody knew anything about them. We were finding nests. No one knew they nested there. No one knew anything about their nesting behavior, where they foraged, what they ate. And so that's how that study started. And you don't go and undertake a study like that for a short amount of time. It's got to be long-term. And you have to understand how the forest works. So the birds, you know, their movements are definitely defined by the forest. And it's a very long process. So saying that, I received funding every year to do that. And I came up with some really great data. I was a co-author of a paper that never got published because the author never finished the final draft, unfortunately. And now it seems kind of pointless because the area isn't there anymore and the birds have been decreased in their numbers. And I think the predictions will hold true that in two generations there will not be scarlet macaws in Belize anymore.
When you were doing this study, there were about 200.
There were about 200. Some people said less. I think there were more or less about 200 birds. We would see large flocks at certain times of the year when their favorite fruiting trees were in fruit. And you have to assume you're not seeing the entire population. They had a very interesting in-forest migration where they would reproduce in the area where I studied, and then they would fly over the Maya Mountains and go to a piece of forest not that far from the Coxcomb where a certain fruit, their favorite fruit, trying to think of the local name, it's anyway, they would go there in great numbers, and you have to assume that you're not seeing the entire population. And then you see other macaws in the reproductive grounds, and they would fly back and forth. And it was a beautiful event to witness because you figured, my goodness, it must have taken thousands and thousands of years of understanding the forest from their terms to be able to connect the north to the south. So, there was a strong Xylopia frutescens is the genus and species. I can't remember the common name, but it's Xylopia. Anyway, how they managed to communicate to each other, these are very, very smart birds. They have a very strong communication link to one another. They bond for life. They both raise the young together. They teach the young over a period of 2 years, which trees are good to nest in, how to avoid predators, where to find water. I always thought it was interesting that in the very heat of the, awful hot, dry season, we'd be out in the bush watching these birds, and it was so hot. And there's the river right there, but they would not go down to the river to drink. They depended on water caught in bromeliads or in the crotch of trees, tree trunks way high in the canopy. The birds do not go to the river to drink. And I always thought that was interesting. We learned a lot. We learned food items that they would eat that no one knew. And, of course, the behavior, how they taught their young to fledge, I saw that with my own eyes. I mean,
How did they teach their young to fledge?
It was really interesting. Imagine you're in this cozy little nest 65 feet high, and now it's time to get out of the nest, according to your parents. How does that work? Well, I'll tell you, the youngsters don't voluntarily get out of the nest. That's their big comfort zone. And what the parents do is they get about 15 feet away on a tree, and they call to the bird. And then what happens is the ideal situation is the bird will come out of the nest. It's really scary to watch. You see the bird come out of this nest hole, but the bird can't make it to the branch. He's never flown before. Invariably, what happens is they fall to the ground, and the adults will go down to the ground. It's the only time I've seen them go to the ground and get them to fly upwards. That's the whole idea. And that's a very dangerous situation. I also witnessed that happen where the youngster tried to fly to the parent, fell to the ground, and a tyra ate it right in front of the mother and father. Mm. A tyra is a weasel-like animal. So these poor parents, after they invested months and months of their energy and devotion, saw their youngster eaten alive. It's really rough out in nature. I learned that, that's for sure. But I thought it was interesting that the flying lesson happened more on the ground than in the canopy. The birds just simply can't fly, and the parents waste no time going swooping close to the ground to get them to fly up. That's the whole, their whole objective is to get them to use the wings and follow them. And they won't keep calling from above. They actually go down to the ground and try to coerce them from there in low flight.
This dam that was at the time proposed, how did you come to lead the anti-dam brigade?
Well, I knew that it would destroy that area. And I started writing letters. I mean, I went to government and said, you know, this is really a special area. At that time, I was totally naive into the underhandedness that was behind it with the government. And I didn't realize that no matter what I said from a scientist's point of view, they weren't going to listen anyway. And I just kept forging forward. I was getting criticized, but I just kept on going forward and spreading the word. I was writing letters and getting letters of support from the World Wildlife Fund, from Alan Rabinowitz, who wrote Jaguar, who did that initial study in the Cox film I told you about. And At that point, I had enough credibility behind me from starting the zoo and other conservation activities that it caught the notice of the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, and they contacted me, and I had a talk with their senior attorney, and that was enough for them to decide to come down and do just an initial brief investigation of the scene, which they did, and decided that they would take it up as a campaign, and that's what really empowered the fight. I can only do so much as an individual, but when a powerful organization like the NRDC is behind you, things really started to happen. That's why it lasted for so long. They took these people to court. They had rallies. They got Bobby Kennedy Jr. involved. There was a huge amount of publicity, which brought forward the sinister qualities of it. And that's, I mean, to date, I'm hated by certain members of that old regime simply because the truth was revealed. And I guess it was my fault. I'm the one that got the ball rolling. And people realize that. But it's also made the government a little bit more cautious about what they can do and how they can behave. I mean, it was so rampantly out of hand. And the NRDC is still astounded that they acted with such an unprincipled air. Enemy of the state. I don't want to be their friends. And that didn't bother me at all. They were doing something that hurt the people of Belize, cut through the very biological corridor that I'm talking about, saw the decrease of a population of birds that is so extremely rare. It should be considered a global treasure. And the other day somebody sent me a website and said, "Didn't you take this picture?" And I thought, what's this? And I went on the website, and it's from Mexico, and God knows how they got this picture, but it was a picture of a jaguar standing on a beach looking right at the camera, and I remember the very day I took it. I don't know how they got it. I guess it was out. I made it available to show, say, hey, this is a sign of the level of biodiversity in this area. Look at this. And I hadn't seen that picture in so long, and it really hurt. It really hurt to see it, because I know that jaguar is dead. And people were afraid to speak out. They were afraid they'll lose their jobs. They're afraid this, they're afraid that. The company in Canada was so unprincipled, and the government was extremely corrupt. And there's no way, I don't think, a campaign will ever be able to win if you have people that are complacent because of fear, a corrupt government, and an unprincipled company. How can you beat that?
And that's exactly what happened. It wasn't beat, and it went online in 2006.
Right.
And so what's happened since that dam was built? I know that two government leaders were charged in December 2008 mm-hmm. with a theft mm-hmm. of $10 million mm-hmm. related
and
to
got
this.
Off.
And they got off.
Oh yeah, of course. And even the DPP, now what does that stand for? The country's prosecuting attorney, or that level of looking at what goes on, she said she was surprised. But they actively want to get back into the government again. So I find that, and it shouldn't, people, once they get to that level of visible corruption, should not be allowed to be decision makers on any level. And I fear for this country if those same people get back into the helm. And they don't need any more money. They've stolen enough from this country where they can just go and do whatever they want anyway. So what happens to people? What is this power thing that gears them and drives them and erases any sense of caring for the very people that share their country? Jesus, I wasn't born here, and I have a far higher level of compassion for the people and the natural resources than for these people who call themselves leaders. I don't get it. I will never understand it.
The things that were predicted in the environmental analysis have also come to pass.
Absolutely.
With destruction of some of the corridor.
And people have been warned not to eat the fish due to heightened levels of mercury. Well, the people that live along the river, they've been fishing and eating those fish for generations. Now they can't eat the fish. And I fear they still are because you can't taste mercury. Oh, no, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, I mean, you can't drink the water. The one time I went swimming there, which was about 3 years ago, I haven't been back since, it smelled of machinery oil. I guess they had just left the water out from the dam. The lodges who can't afford to build a pool, swimming pools, have done so because people complain of skin rashes when they swim in the river. And that was all predicted, as well as a decrease in the biodiversity. Well, that's a given. There are less scarlet macaws. I'll use that as the species, but that, you know, it's also cut through jaguar populations, and it's cut through tapir populations. And I know for a fact that, oh, we're going to hire Belizeans. We're going to give people. They didn't hire Belizeans. They brought in, I believe they brought in Chinese to do the dam building. And guess what they ate? Do you think they brought in canned food to eat? They hunted. They hunted anything they could because I knew someone that worked there and they had a specific canoe called the hunting canoe. They ate tapirs. They ate anything they could find, probably scarlet macaws too. So that's what happened, the reality of it is. And the truth of the matter is you can't see it. This went on while everyone tended to their everyday lives. And there really is something to out of sight, out of mind. People don't have to see it. They don't have to deal with it. And they didn't.
And
you can talk about it. You can talk about it and say what a loss it is, but they still don't see the loss.
Has it resulted in the lower energy prices that the companies were saying?
You must be joking. They are really good about, they put in full-page ads. Belize has the lowest energy rates of any country in the Caribbean. Well, you know what? We aren't an island in the Caribbean. Hello there. So I've responded. They hate me. You put ads in the paper. Here is the truth. First of all, perhaps someone should buy the Belize Electricity Limited and Fortis a map. We are in the Caribbean. We are part of the Seven Nation contingency of Central America. In those seven nations, we have the highest energy rates. We have 42 cents a kilowatt hour. That's cheap. And they can't come back to that. So they don't use that propaganda any longer because as soon as they do, I'll tell you, it goes right back in the paper. And the newspapers are sympathetic to the truth. I mean, I can't believe I actually read in one of the papers that used to throw darts at me that I was right. When it came to the Chileo conflict, and it listed a friend of mine who worked with me very hard on it. She's a great lady and a very active social activist. They named us both and said, yep, they were right. Mucked up the river, higher energy rate. And they didn't say we should have listened, but they just said we were right. And there was a little glimmer of satisfaction there, but, you know, it still hurts to think about it. The horrible loss.
And the scarlet macaws, what do macaws need to nest?
They're very specific nest sighting birds. I mean, that's what the prime minister used to say, one of the gentlemen who was arrested in 2008. It's a bird. It'll fly to another tree. And that's what people want to hear. And there is something to people believe what they want to believe. But sorry, everybody, it doesn't work that way. They need a specific type of tree. It has to be completely able to support a nest. It has to be a softwood tree. It has to be clear around it so predators can't climb up. It has to give them a 360 view of the environment to watch out for predators. It's got to be a place that can provide them with food and with water. So you're not going to find them in a pine tree, an oak tree, a palm tree. There's a certain amount of tree that grows on a specific type of habitat that, again, affords them a variety of food to eat. Everything's based on the food and the availability of it. In a tropical forest, certain trees do not fruit every year. Their favorite fruit trees might have a really good fruiting year in 1999, which they did, and then in 2000, hardly anything came to fruit. So these birds need to know what's available out there. They have to have a fairly Catholic diet in order to survive and to feed their young. So just because there's a forest doesn't mean that the birds can exist. They need a specific type of habitat. And that's what was so disappointing when the dam was put in, because a very important habitat which supports, you know, a very critical population of birds was just eradicated.
How would you advise other people fighting similar types of dams? Because all over the world there are a number of examples where similar things are about to happen. And what would be your advice to people in these areas about how to successfully fight a dam, or what to avoid to unsuccessfully?
Yeah. I think there's a whole worldwide problem in hydropower. I don't think it is the most sensible type of power production to look at anymore. But again, you're talking about a big economic machine. My only experience in what works to get people thinking the right way is education. And the earlier that education starts, the better. I mean, maybe if these two rogues who called themselves government leaders had a different education when they were 8 or 6, maybe they wouldn't have turned out the way they did. I see that in the kids that I work with. I work with preschoolers, and they're so eager to learn, and they're so willing to see that natural resources do have value. And these are 4 and 5-year-olds. But it's kind of senseless to think that you're going to be stopping a dam when you're dealing with people who lack sensibility. So that's the first challenge. And the only other advice I would say is to educate yourself on the dam itself, the amount of power production, what it's going to destroy, and advise people on it. It's very, very hard, if not impossible, to fight something called human greed. Money does seem to play a significant role of value in most people's lives. So right now we're dealing with offshore drilling issues in Belize. And again, I can see the same problems kind of emerging that are reminiscent of Chileo Dam. It's all about money. It isn't about the resource, except there's a far wider show of support against it because, again, it's something that's in people's faces. People live along that reef. Many people, huge amount of people make them. They're living off that reef through tourism and snorkeling and diving. And the idea of an oil spill or even just putting in the infrastructure, which does a huge amount of damage, people aren't settling for that. And there's a big, big, big turnabout in outcry, which I'm really pleased to see. But you can see it. You can see it. Remember, in the upper Raspakula, where I did my study, tourists didn't go there. People made no money off of it. Tour guides didn't go there. It was just a beautiful, pristine, untouched area that is now not there any longer. And people can shake their heads. Yeah, it's a shame. They never saw it. So they don't really understand the depth of the loss.
Now, your zoo, one of its key components is to let people see what's there. And I wanted to talk about another animal that we haven't really touched on, and you have another book coming out in 2011, The Story of Tambo the Tapir. And you had said you were studying them, and I know they were affected by this dam as well. But why, you know, what makes a tapir so special?
Well, it is a very endangered animal. And that, combined with that they've been around for millions of years, and they are very important seed dispersers, so their role in forest ecology is significant. They spread the forest. It's a national animal, I believe.
It is, and the national animal.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And that's what really kind of put me on overdrive when I started the zoo and started to get to know the people of Belize and what they thought of their wildlife, because I would go into schools and ask the kids to draw a picture of a tapir, and nobody could. Nobody could. I know it was a prevalent myth that the tapir was dangerous. It could skin you alive with its nose. And I mean, everybody believed that. I just hear it all the time. So that's what made me get the idea of writing my first children's book called Hoodwink the Owl, and it's all about just erasing those myths that harm wildlife. I mean, I can't believe tapirs are better off if everybody thinks they're dangerous, because they'll skin you alive. That's not good. And anteaters are dangerous because they'll steal your dog and force their tongue up the dog's nose and suck out its brains. I mean, these were really things people believed. And again, the education effort that the zoo's put forward has changed attitudes. I know that. I've talked to people, and it's a very rewarding thing. And I've seen it happen in the recent past with the harpy eagle. That harpy eagle is now a big hero in Belize. We personalized the birds and made people really see how not just beautiful they are, but what a splendid part of the Belizean landscape they are now. And when I first got involved in starting that program with the Peregrine Fund, I would hear things like, oh, they're going to eat all our howler monkeys. I used to hear that from intelligent people. And over time, which education is a process that does go over time, those thoughts that weren't accurate were turned around with facts. So the zoo does a really good job of transferring basic information, making it fun to learn about the basic information, because the animals are right there, up close and personal. And you can't go in the zoo and walk out without feeling really proud of what lives in Belize.
Can kids have interactions with tapirs?
In Belize?
In
the zoo.
In the zoo.
Oh, absolutely. We have the tapirs come right up to meet people. And we have one, his name's Indy, and he has, even though Indy's over a year old and shouldn't have his baba, he still gets his baba because he likes it. And we let kids hold this huge, it's a cattle bottle, you know, what you give to a calf, so it's huge. So they hold the bottle, and Indy just loves it. I mean, he eats solid food as well, but his treat is getting his little milkshake when kids come through. And they just change, you know, okay, you can hold it for 5 seconds and give it to your friend, and so everybody gets to feed him. So, yeah, there's a lot of interaction. They can feed him bananas. And also the other tapirs, we have 5 tapirs on exhibit.
Is one of those Tambo, who you're writing
Tambo
about?
Tambo's off exhibit right now. The plan was to, this is pretty interesting, the plan was to introduce Tambo to the other tapir troop right about now. But what happened, that would be the end of the book. Then Tambo goes to the zoo, end of story. But the story's taken an interesting swerve because the zoo in Chetumal, which is right north of us in Mexico, they're part of the forest corridor, called the Selva Maya. Selva Maya is a 22,000 kilometer square tract of forest, which is the largest tract of forest north of the Amazon. And that is the forest where we focused our release efforts with the Harpy Eagle. We tried to promote tri-national cooperation on biodiversity protection with Guatemala, Mexico, and Belize. Anyway, I was contacted by the mayor of Chetumal and the honorary consul to Belize about my coming up there to see the Chetumal Zoo, and they would like to have a tape here for the zoo. And I thought, are you out of your mind? I mean, I have been to the Chetumal Zoo. Mind you, it's been 4 years, and I wouldn't send a fire ant colony there. But I was very diplomatic and quite nice and said, oh, as soon as I get time, I'll try to work it in my schedule. But I'm really busy, and, you know. But you know what? They kept persisting. And at the end of August, this past August, here comes the mayor of Chetumal, the Mexican ambassador to Belize, the paparazzi from Mexico. They all came to the zoo. I had no idea that it would be so extravagant. I thought I was going to get a few visitors from the Chetumal Zoo. Oh, no. The director of the zoo, they pulled up in this beautiful car and wanted to look around. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? And so then they met Tambo. I took them in to meet Tambo. And, of course, they said, well, you know what? We've had the zoo closed for, it was closed for a couple of years, and we renovated it. And we really want you to come up and see it and see how special it really is. And I said, well, again, they were persistent. And it was right before September. They actually sent a diplomatic vehicle to pick me up, three of my colleagues, because I was not going alone, drove us into Mexico to the newly renovated Chetumal Zoo, which I was, you know, at that point, my curiosity is very at a high level. And I said to my animal management supervisor, I said, you know what, in an ideal world, Tambo is taper number 6 for us. In an ideal world, if there were a situation where it would be a beautiful place for him to live and the care was high quality, then I could consider it, because they were talking about a friendship. A friendship, a gesture of friendship between our two countries to reinforce the value of the biodiversity that we share, because we are both part of the Selva Maya. And I love that. I love that concept. Whether I would love saying goodbye to Tambo is another thing, especially if the zoo were something I, you know, had my doubts about. Well, anyway, we went there. And you know what? What an extraordinary zoological facility. I was so impressed. It is one of the most beautiful zoos I think I've ever seen. It's all regional animals. They haven't opened it yet. They wanted our opinion on the tapir exhibit because, you know, they've never had tapirs. I thought that was pretty cool. A lot of zoos will just build an exhibit and figure that it's okay. Well, it was quite an experience. They have canopy walkways. They have a fog machine in the rainforest part of it for their jaguars. Their enclosures are roomy. The people that work there are all professionals. They're biologists. It was stunning. And to make it even more attractive, they have available a female tapir about Tambo's age that was captive bred at the Chiapas Zoo. And the significance of that, I think, is really interesting. The Chiapas Zoo is the zoo that the Belize Zoo is modeled after.
Hmm. Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Isn't that something? Yep. Because it was all regional animals, and they used innovative techniques like keeping monkeys in with electric. And I went there, and I sent the people who were my workers, I sent them there while I was fundraising money to build the new zoo. And then I later went there to see it. And we modeled the Belize Zoo or the Chiapas Zoo. So I thought it was appropriate that here comes this female tapir. And so then we thought, yeah, we'll really make a big deal out of it. We'll have a wedding and marry them. And I thought, okay, I cannot give Tambo the tapir what they can give him. He's got a beautiful exhibit, a bride, excellent care, and we're not that far. I mean, we would come and visit. I would go there once a month to check on him just because I like you so much. But it also does something very extraordinary. It strengthens a bond of friendship between Mexico and Belize, which I think is really important. And that's one of the things that this present government has been trying to amplify, is to strengthen our relationships with Mexico. So it all fits in well. And then I understand that the Prime Minister of Belize is aware of this possible transfer. I've already met with the Chief Forest Officer on it. Everybody's for it. Everybody thinks it's wonderful. And I feel really happy about it. So Tambo the tapir will be taking a little bit of a turn in his story, and he will go to Chetumal and learn that his importance is, it's international. He's going to be drawing attention to the significant biodiversity in a forest that's shared by three nations, and he's going to be drawing attention to that. So his role in life is really a significant role. So that's the story of Tambo the tapir. And I met with the Mexican ambassador just last week, because it's a series of photographs, and the book is told by Tambo, not told by me, how he lost his mother and how sad he was, you know, that kind of thing. And then everything is, it's a picture book. And the picture that has him kind of preparing his mind about Mexico is the Mexican ambassador showing him the Mexican flag. So that's, in fact, that's the next picture that's scheduled to happen. Huh. So he learns conservation lessons throughout the book. He's got someone who was involved with black howler monkeys showing him a poster of a black howler monkey, and just things like that. It's for kids, and it's to instill. Oh, and the scarlet macaw. He's nosed the beak nearly with a scarlet macaw, and then the companion picture to that is my showing him Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, like I'm explaining him the very story. That so it's really kind of cute. It's he's so tame, you can get very close. I'm sitting there playing the guitar to him when he's a little baby, so he gets soothed and about the, you know, his new home, and he meets children, got kids giving him his baba. So the story evolves over time, and it will end when he goes to Chetumal.
And when is that scheduled to happen?
Good question. Everybody wants it to happen quickly, but it's dependent on the Mexicans issuing an import permit to Belize, and then we respond with an export permit. And that letter is going out tomorrow to inform them. They already know, but they need to have something very solid on paper. The Mexican ambassador needs to write a diplomatic letter. I don't mean a diplomatic letter. I mean a letter from his diplomatic reign, I guess, to the government stating the purpose, which is all on my flash drive, Laurel, and I can't get into my computer. It's just stopped working today. So that's part of the problem right now. I need to find a place to. I'm sure it'll work out next week. Computers don't stay down forever, but we're always fighting these little hurdles.
Stop.
You know, I can't send the letter as an attachment if the email doesn't work. See, that's my problem right now.
And what is Tambo's personality? Because it sounds like you're very attached to him, and he sounds like a really special animal.
Yeah, he is a wonderful guy. He likes to come over. And so his routine is really the same and simple. He comes over, first eats a banana. You have to break it in half. And then he'll drink his baba. He drinks about 8 bottles of kefir milk or horse replacement milk. And then you see his belly get bigger and bigger, and he starts belching. He's really cute. Like a baby. And
how old is he now? How old is he?
Sambo is about 8 months old now. And then he lies down, and he likes to be scratched with a stick. Everybody was using a brush at first, but he prefers a stick. And as soon as you touch him with a stick, he just kind of falls over, gives a little groan. And I know his favorite place is to get scratched under the chin, his belly, down his legs. He likes his legs scratched with a stick. And he's just lies there, lets you scratch him. But, you know, you spend about a half hour or more with him, and he just looks forward to it, and he just enjoys the company. It's really nice. And that kind of behavior is being increased and reinforced because we want him to be as trackable as he can be when he's moved. And the keeper that primarily works with him will be going to Chetamal with him and spending time there training their keepers. And probably from the initial talks in Chetamal, a couple of their keepers will come to the Belize Zoo and see how we manage our tapirs.
And how do you manage a tapir? What goes into tapir care?
Just a lot of attention and good food, scratching under the chin, talking. They love that, talking nice to them. That's tapir care, keeping an eye on their, if it rains too much, you don't want their feet to get wet, for instance, because it could split their soft part of their hoof from the nail, which is a deadly thing, causes infection. So it's just keeping an eye on them and working with them on a daily basis.
Well, again, thank you so much. I appreciate your taking time to talk with me. And good luck. And again, I'm hoping now I'm really hoping to come down and visit at some point. So that's
all.
Well,
I'm just going to invite you. I just hope that happens. And you're always welcome here.
Well, thank you. You watch out, because I'm going to take you up on it.
All right. Okay, that's fine. No problem. But, thank you for your interest. I really appreciate that.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about tapirs and the fight to protect biodiversity near the Macaw River with Sharon Matola, founder and director of the Belize Zoo. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.